Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Alan Levy Show at blogtalkradio.com. Be prepared to call in now and chat with Alan and his very special guest right here at blogtalkradio.com. With no more further ado, please welcome your host, Mr. Alan Levy.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Alan Levy Show on Blog Talk Radio. It's really a pleasure to be here. Monday night, March 1st. Once again, thanks for joining me. You can find this, the show is live here at blogtalkradio.com. The archive will be found at blogtalkradio.com/Alan Levy. I've let the world know that we have a very special guest on today, none other than Andrew Keen. And Andrew's on here, and we'll get to him in a moment. But it's been a while since I've been back here on air, and I really do miss it. And this week I'm actually going to be doing three shows. I'll be guests on two other shows, so it's time to get back in the mix and to get back to the my first love, which is talk radio, and that's why we created Blog Talk Radio. For those of you that have been following us on the network, we've just hosted last week about the 500,000th episode of the network, and we're hosting more than 1,200 a day. So I'm happy to be one of those hosts, and there's tens of thousands of others that are using this platform to get their messages out. So my guest is Andrew Keen, and if you look, you could follow him on Twitter at AJ Keen, I believe, and he calls himself the self-proclaimed Antichrist of Silicon Valley. He's written a book that he's written called The Cult of the Amateur, How Today's Internet is Killing Our Culture, was well-received and critically acclaimed, and Andrew's my guest today. How are you, Andrew?
Hi, Alan. Very well, thank you.
Wonderful, wonderful. So I was kind of looking around to find a description of how to introduce you, and I found exactly what I needed on your Twitter profile, the Antichrist of Silicon Valley. So tell our audience why is that?
I'm not sure if it's self-proclaimed. You know, the mists of history now are so thick that one can never tell whether something is made up or not. And particularly when you do away with professional editors, everything becomes a bit misty. I'm the Antichrist because the Silicon Valley is a church, and I challenged it. So those who challenge belief often are called the Antichrist.
Well,
heretic,
I mean,
my son is telling me.
Heretic.
I'm heretical.
Well, first of all, this is your own profile, so it I think it's self-proclaimed. Of course, you may not have come up with the term, of course.
You know what Twitter's like. You can never trust it. There's always someone fiddling with your identity.
Someone who may have hacked into your Twitter profile.
I never trust anything, particularly when it pertains to myself.
Well, you may be the Antichrist, but I see that the Antichrist was invited on an episode of the Gilmore Gang last night, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, no, I'm on that as the anti-Gilmore.
Well, I think it's wonderful. So our audience is not really that familiar with you. At Blog Talk Radio, we're kind of the anti-technorati here, I'd say.
Okay, well, that's good.
And that's maybe why we're succeeding so well and keep growing, and because it's all about empowerment here, and it's not necessarily about who has the most Twitter followers. I mean, if you reach that one person or that 10 or 100 people, it's important, and we provide that platform. So maybe you could tell my audience a bit about your background, and then we can get into some the back and forth here. I'd love to talk about some of the current issues.
I have to admit, though, Alan, I'm not keen on that word empowerment.
You're not keen on it,
okay?
And why is it a bad? Why is empowerment not a good word?
Because it smacks of an underclass.
Well, but isn't okay? But in traditional media, as we know it, right? Isn't there clearly it does not enable and provide a platform for people to get their message out effectively?
Well, I'm also not, excusing the pun, not keen on the concept of media as empowerment, or anything actually as empowerment, politics, media, culture.
Right. Okay.
These are are words invented by sociologists or people in the religious people in the business of making people feel better about themselves. And I think when it comes to media, for example, the purpose of media is not to make people feel better about themselves, to make them more educated and knowledgeable about the world. So one of the problems, one of the areas that I've been critical of about the internet, this has nothing to do with technology, has it's become this ideal place for narcissism and narcissists, people who want to feel better about themselves, and rather than learning from people who know more about the world than themselves, they're using it to peddle their own insecurities and obsessions and peculiarities. So I'm not keen on the word empowerment. I only ever use it in a satirical way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I mean,
you'll still talk to me though, right?
Of course I will, of course.
Good.
But you've made a generalized statement there in terms of this
narcissistic
view.
Very general.
Yeah, I would say. Well, I can only respond, I mean, as the founder of this platform, whether you don't agree with the word entitlement, empowerment, and it's not that I'm saying entitlement. It's just I get very often emails from hosts. In fact, there's one in the chat room today called Mama Joyce, who sent me an email to my Blog Talk Radio account, thanking us for this platform, which was very nice, because whether, you know, and she may reach one person to affect, and she's done 30 years of charity, and here she has an opportunity to reach people. So maybe I didn't use the proper term, but I certainly understand what you're saying. What is, you know, I see that you and Larry Lessig disagree. What do you disagree about?
Well, he believes that he wrote a book called Remix, and he believes that one of the big problems with our cultural economy at the moment is that the copyright laws are too strict, and he thinks that the most exciting thing in cultural creation is remixing. So he wants to liberalize copyright laws, and I'm not so convinced by that. I think that most creative people aren't remixers, at least formally. And
right.
The idea of the remix, and for your audience, what a remix means is that you take a song, for example, on the internet, and you add your own commentary. I'm not convinced that the idea of the remix is a particularly a credible artistic form. I mean, it's interesting, but I don't think it has legs. And I'm also different from Lessig in the sense that I think he sees the internet as empowering, and I don't. Or at least he would like to see it as empowering, and I'm not keen on the notion of empowerment,
mm-hmm.
particularly in terms of media. For me, you know, media, the best form of media, as I said, is education. Lessig, I think, is also extremely suspicious of large media companies. I think he believes, for the most part, that they're intrinsically bad, corrupt, self-interested, and poor at their job, which is providing information. And I'm not convinced by that.
Mm-hmm.
Lessig is also very close to Google as a company, and I'm not. I'm not that sympathetic with what Google is doing, whereas he, I think, is. But, you know, you need to have him on the show to speak for himself.
Yeah.
He's certainly able to speak for himself.
Of course he is. Anyway, people can, we'd love you to call in to the show live. We have a switchboard here. We manage the switchboard. The phone number is 347-677-0649. You can join us on the chat room as well at 347-677-0649. So what's your view of Twitter? I mean, if you're talking about this mad free-for-all, I mean, just curious, and maybe we can get it a bit. And you may not think it's a mad free-for-all. I see that you're on it and you're active.
No, I love Twitter. I mean, I think that it's fun. It's a great way to meet people. Some ways, Twitter's changed my life. What Twitter isn't good at, though, is reliably telling you about the world. All it is sort of an endless procession of people's views, often narcissistic, although sometimes they're actually quite interesting and entertaining. So Twitter is great, but it's not a replacement for traditional media. And what I like about Twitter is I don't think it's quite as diluted as some of the other more recent internet media forms, which have represented themselves as replacements of newspapers or record labels or movie studios. And Twitter doesn't pretend to be anything but Twitter. So I don't have any problem with Twitter, although I do tend to try and ration my own time on it because it's very easy to waste several hours doing absolutely nothing. I think it's even more wasteful than television, which is why I don't have a television. But I, from a writer's point of view, I think Twitter is excellent. You know, I have a few thousand followers, and it's a great way to easily distribute your ideas. It's a great way to show off your skills as a writer. So I think for writers, Twitter is a godsend. And I think any writer who isn't on Twitter is making a very serious mistake. Having said that, though, Twitter is not a replacement for the novel, for the book, for the publishing industry. Twitter is just Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, the media platforms certainly have embraced it, and I was watching a local TV news, you know, in New York, Channel 5, and the sports reporter, the guy doing the sports, you know, in his 3 minutes says, and please join me at Twitter at www.twitter.com/sportstalkguy, you know, and that briefly, I mean, there's, you know, 12 people there, of course, but they'll continuously promote that.
Well, the thing, though, also about Twitter, which everyone must understand, is that it's not a solution to the problem of media. They're struggling to figure out the business model. It doesn't have advertising. It's free. So it falls into some of the traps of internet media. It gives out an excellent service for free, not even bothering to try and build a business around advertising. So there's still a very serious question about whether or not Twitter can grow into a viable business. They do have some ways of making money, and I think I'm more confident about their money-making ability than a number of other companies, particularly since they're not absolutely reliant on advertising. But Twitter does raise many of the problems of other internet companies, which I get into in some detail in my book, which is that they're lacking a business model. When you give services or technologies or content away for free, it's very hard to actually turn whatever you're doing into a business, which is why it's more like a religious movement and why, of course, I like to think of myself as the Antichrist.
Well, it is. That's a good analogy there. I fully agree with you as someone who's founded a company, and I built a telecom company in the 90s, of course, one that sold services on a monthly basis, and at BlogTalk we've been evolving and building a model here, and I've always been focused on it. I haven't had a full open API, and maybe we've lost out on growth to that end, but you know, you have to build a business at the end of the day to maintain these platforms, and I think Twitter will. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with, you know, TweetDeck and Seismic and some of these clients out there and these platforms. What do you have a view on that in terms of where the engagement is? It's just so much being built on top of this beast that can control, you know, dictate the data flow and what these other platforms look like.
I think that some of them are clearly lacking a business model. I use TweetDeck myself, and I think it's a good service and a good product. Now there are rumors that Twitter is itself going to bring out competing products. My guess is that 99% of these Twitter ecosystem companies and products will die in the next year or two. Certainly 90%. I think if one out of 10 survives, it will actually be a success. Most of them haven't been properly thought through. Most of them are founded with very little capital, with just
right.
some intellectual sweat. So failure is not a catastrophe. Many of the people who start one thing go on to start something else. Seismic, for example, which is founded by a Frenchman called Loic Lemieux, who's a French immigrant to Silicon Valley. He had a video startup company, and then he saw the opportunity with Seismic and shifted his company. So Seismic, a couple of years ago, was something entirely different. And in a couple of years' time, will probably be different again. So I don't think it's so troubling. The first internet boom of the late 90s was very troubling because the public markets were involved. So many, many quote-unquote innocent people lost a lot of money when the market crashed in the spring of 2000, Black Monday, April 2000. But today, when an internet startup, a Twitter client company goes bankrupt, doesn't really matter to anyone. It certainly doesn't matter to anyone outside the immediate company. It doesn't really have any significant economic ramifications for the broader economy.
I mean, I would disagree. First, I certainly agree that in the 90s, and I was part of it in the sense I ran a telecom company, which we ultimately sold in 99, December 99, and we built a European phone company. So we had services, and we sold it, and we kind of were timely in that. But
who did you sell it to?
I sold it to a company called Viettel. I was a UK-based company, which ultimately went bankrupt. But it was a time when all these...
money.
I made some money. I made enough money that I could at least build Blog Talk Radio to this point. So with the help of some other key investors. So I was fortunate and kind of wise to it. I mean, we were building a European phone company at the time that KPN Quest and Global Crossing and all these companies were building fiber in the same conduit, and we were building customer bases. But that being said, and you know, looking at this experience today, I would argue that the Twitter platform, the one that without the regard for a business plan, is damaging, not just only Twitter, but others, is damaging traditional media platforms that, of course, are seeing content just being aggregated and disseminated in so many places, and whether it's traditional newspapers, you know, whether it's the Times or the Journal and whatnot, and others. So
yeah, I don't agree with that. I mean, I tend to agree with somebody like Jeff Jarvis on this one. I should never say that publicly, but I will say it. I hope no one's listening.
We're
going to
pull that out and definitely post it for our blog.
But I think the fact that people can freely link Twitter posts to New York Times pieces is a good thing for the New York Times. I'm not convinced. I mean, I'm a major critic of Google. You won't find many people who are more critical of Google. But I'm not really convinced by the Google News argument. Because I don't really think that Google is stealing content from Google. Just as certainly Twitter isn't stealing content from the newspapers or the magazines. All they're doing are providing links. And I know that the most of the time I use Twitter, I do it to give links to pieces that I think have value. And many of those, for example, are in the New York Times. So I'm providing the New York Times with readers. Now, if the New York Times decides that they want to put paywalls around their product, which I think they have done, that's their right, and I won't be able to do it. But at the moment, all the New York Times content is free, and it's in my interest as a sort of a tastemaker to send my readers to relevant pieces, and the New York Times benefits from getting new readers who might eventually turn into subscribers. So I don't see there being any problem with that.
Well, I think David Carr, you read his piece, I'm sure, where he was talking about dollars turned into pennies, digital dollars,
that's true, but that's not the problem with the broader economy. That's a problem with free content. If the New York Times gives out its stuff for free, or the Guardian gives their stuff out for free, not Twitter's fault that people using this platform send links.
Right. No, I agree. I think they're mistaken. It's just a structural problem, and I'm not saying it's a Twitter problem. I agree. You're sending traffic to the New York Times. It's just an interesting dynamic of what's happening. So I have a caller, and I have to warn you. It was Mama Joyce, who hosts the show on Blog Talk Radio, sent me this email. Who who I referred to earlier in the show, and wants to come on, and I think she has a comment or a question.
Oh, good.
Okay. Wonderful. So let me bring her on.
Is this your mother?
No, no, it's not. It's not. It's definitely not.
So, I could be.
You could be, possibly.
I could be everybody's mama.
Okay, so Mama Joyce, how are you? So welcome
wonderful.
To the Alan Levy Show.
Thank you, Alan. And hello, Andrew. How are you?
Very well, Joyce. Nice
good.
To see you.
I'm enjoying your comments and your perspective on bees. I just would like to say, now I've been on this venue for several months now, and I started out being free, you know, where I didn't pay, and I understand what you were saying, Andrew, but you know what? Nobody that I know of who begins free ever stays free, because we want to support this venue. We want to invest in it because we can get messages of hope out there. There's all different kinds of people on the Blog Talk Radio. He's given us a platform to share views. And you know what? My radio show does reach quite a few people. I've had people sending me clothes and food to help feed the homeless, you know. And these are, it's a fantastic connection. I mean, Alan is a genius when it comes to creating such a thing, and also has compassion and sensitivity to people like myself who need a venue and can't really go out on in the media or, you know, something like that. And we can connect. So it's an outstanding platform, and what you've done, Alan, is tremendous.
Thanks, Mom. I'm just kidding. You're not my mother. We have no relation.
No.
All I know that you sent me an email
you.
The other day. So, Andrew, I didn't...
Well, tell me, Alan, what kind of audience is listening to this? Is anyone? How many people would you estimate?
Well, it depends upon, you know, when they listen live.
I don't want to hear the depends. I want to know how many people.
No, it's not... Well, right. But again, no. What I'm saying is that our shows are live and then they're on demand. So,
okay.
For example,
how many people listen live?
We'll probably get maybe about 50, 75, and probably get about 2,000 archives.
Oh, well, that's not bad.
No, I mean, I interviewed David Baldacci.
That's not the business, right? No, you're not going to find any sponsors for that.
No, but we have, like I said, we have about 7.5 million listeners a month to all of our shows. So we have 1,200.
How many shows do you have?
We have 1,200 live broadcasts per day. We've broadcast over 500,000. 1,200.
Oh, so this is not just you. It's,
no, it's a full network.
Oh,
it's a
wow.
full. I've had President Obama and Brad Pitt and McCain and it's.
I bet
it's
they got more than 75.
No, of course, Obama live show had 100,000 live at one time.
And you interviewed him.
No, I didn't interview him. Actually, we enable. I don't want to say the empowerment, but we faith group, 40 churches and mosques, temples interviewed him. In August, which was well promoted, and we were exclusive network. I'm the founder of Blog Talk Radio, and I came up with the idea by merging the phone network with the web to result in this network. So anyway, so this show, again, you know, I'm probably one. I don't have a lot of live listeners. There's shows that have many more than I just, I'm a sometime host, but Mama. Came on, and she's listening, and she felt compelled to call in and make a comment. So thank you for calling in. Where do you live, by the way?
It's my pleasure. I live in the San Fernando Valley in California.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, very nice.
And what do you do? So you said you work in a church, or you have a church?
No, I don't. I'm not into organized religion, but what I do is I do volunteer work in the community and have done so 30 years. I try to, reach the needs of the people in the community, and I go to the people, Alan. Mm-hmm. Whatever donations come in of food and clothing, or I offer free rides to the elderly and disabled, to the doctor's offices, to the grocery store, and I make myself available to those who are in need.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a noble thing, and that's wonderful, actually. Thank you for calling in. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, and keep up the good work.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
So, Andrea, I didn't put her up to that, I assure you. So what do you think, make of the paywall decision by Murdoch?
I tend to think that the newspapers did make a mistake giving their stuff away for free. I think it was I think in historical terms it will be seen to be a major error in the 90s that they all went online and just gave the stuff up because they were seduced by the idea that advertising would cover the
cost. I fully agree with you.
Free. But now, having done it, I don't think it can be reversed. I rather like Murdoch. I think he's very... I think he'll be beaten on this, but I think he's quite brave in his own way because I don't think he needs this fight. I don't like, for the most part, his politics. I certainly don't like Fox Network. But I like the fact that he's standing up to Google, even if I don't necessarily agree specifically on the issue, but I think I like the symbolic element of it. And I actually think the Wall Street Journal is quite a good newspaper. I think there's a problem in the sense, for example, that one of the best online newspapers is the London Guardian. It's one I use all the time. I think it has a bigger reading now than most American newspapers, including the LA Times. But the Guardian newspaper is run by a trust. It's not a for-profit organization. So they can afford to lose money. The Wall Street Journal can, in a sense, afford to lose money because it's part of a larger media company. But the New York Times is a for-profit company and a relatively small company, the New York Times Company. So they're in a much more difficult situation. I've been involved with some consulting for the New York Times, and I know how painful it's been for them to come to a decision about whether or not to put paywalls up. I don't quite understand why it's taken so long. I think it's going to be very hard to build a business around paywalls unless they're creative, unless they create affinity groups and all sorts of other ways of making the reader or the user more loyal to the brand. But consumers now have become so spoiled with the idea of free content that they're not willing to pay.
Right.
And unless all newspapers go away and suddenly people are left without news, which I don't think is going to happen because there's television, there's radio, there's state-supported stuff.
There's writers.
Right. So, I'm all in favor of paying for news. I don't have any problem personally paying for news. In fact, I'd rather pay for news because I think it improves the quality. The Financial Times, for example, created a paywall. I think that's the best newspaper in the world. But I think I'm unfortunately in a minority there.
I think Newsday, if I read some crazy number, you know, they enacted the paywall and had something like 59 people subscribe to it, some abysmally low.
Well, what annoys me is that people seem to get pleasure out of this.
I don't.
The problem with this paywall debate is it's become so politicized that people think that it's somehow wrong, immoral, to want to charge for content. And I find that very annoying. I mean, the reality is that there are many different business models for building media companies on the internet, but the core one is still selling your content. And if you give that one away, then everything else becomes increasingly difficult.
Well, what's compounded the problem too is that they are giving the news away, but now that when you're developing a full online real-time news platform to keep up with Twitter or the real-time web, you have so many more resources you need to allocate to these areas, and so not only are you not getting paid.
Well, again, I don't agree with that because I think Twitter is not a rival.
No, forget Twitter. All right, put them aside. Let's say the New York Times, prior to to make their online platform, in my view, as robust as it needs to be, is dedicating far more news. In the past, it would be writing and preparing for print, and then go out in the morning edition. I mean, again, it's 3-4 years ago. We're talking about it. Don't you think there's more resources being allocated to online and less dollars that are coming in, of course?
Well, I think that the New York Times and all these traditional newspapers and media operations are being forced to rethink their content, their product, in an age where the audience is seizing power, where interactivity has become the new kind of the new orthodoxy. And the old world of a clear distinction between audience and author is going away. Now, I wrote a book which I was rather sad about that, and I'm still nostalgic for an age where people listened to other people who knew more than they did and read and listened and watched them. But unfortunately, our culture seems to be moving away from that.
What did you make of the Google story in Italy?
Well, I found it very amusing. Symbolically, I think it's great that any opportunity to put senior Google executives in jail, I'm in favor of.
Okay.
You know, I think it didn't necessarily make the Italians look that good. It was rather a farcical story, but it does again raise this fundamental issue, which is Google or YouTube have an open platform. They allow anyone to post anything. Do or should they have a responsibility for what gets posted? Now, my argument would be, when it comes to YouTube, is that YouTube does have a responsibility. Google will say, well, we can't, how could, you know, with the thousands of videos being uploaded every minute, how can we check? You can check, because the algorithm isn't sufficient, but you can employ a lot of human beings. And if you can't, then maybe it's not a very viable business. But I think that these platforms, Yelp is another example where they found themselves in court being sued by an angry restaurant owner. If you create a platform which allows anyone to say anything or show anything, and then somebody uses that platform to put up something offensive or disgusting or illegal, then I think the owners of a platform do have an element of responsibility. They can't just stand back and hold up their arms and say, well, we're just the platform providers. We don't have a responsibility. They do have a responsibility because it's their business. They're profiting from it. They're selling advertising around it. And so they have a responsibility to do everything they can to eliminate illegal content. I mean, YouTube had the same problem when it came to stolen content. They're being sued, I think, still by Viacom for $2 billion because so many people were putting stolen video content up on YouTube, which is one of the reasons why it became so popular. Everyone was finding television and movie stuff which was illegal, which was stolen. So I tend to think that, you know, the Italian story is funny, and it's also sad because of the actual story of a bullied child. But I think beyond all that, these platform companies do have a responsibility. So that's my feeling.
Okay, so we have a call. We'll bring in another caller. Morgan, let's just get him on. Morgan Lawrence should be on any moment here. Morgan, how are you?
Good evening. How are you?
Good. Where are you from? Where are you calling from, Morgan?
I'm calling from Palm Beach, Florida.
Wonderful. And you have a question for...
I had kind of a comment more than a question.
Well,
please. Sociologically today, things are a whole lot different than they were, say, 10 or 20 years ago. And the concept of information exchange sociologically has changed in that we are a culture of instant gratification and instant information retrieval. We don't take time to read magazines or newspapers like maybe in the old days that were very popular then. And why support a mechanism that's going to slow you down on information exchange when you can get a lot of the same information for free online by surfing the web?
Andrew?
Well, that's an interesting comment, but let's say you're in the business of creating information. Let's say you're building an encyclopedia, or you're an expert on politics or culture or the movies. If all the information is free, how are you going to get paid?
Well, that's the hook.
I think that what do you do? What's your business?
I'm a forensic psychologist by trade.
Right, well, how would you feel if I wandered into your office and said, well, I'm in... I fancy a bit of forensic psychology, but I'm just going to take it for free, and I don't really want to pay you.
Well, I do a fair amount of pro bono work, but...
You only do pro bono work because mostly you're paid for your work, right? So I don't have a problem with people giving stuff away for free if they want to, if they're wealthy enough or stupid enough. But most people in the creative or the information industry, creative people, people who are creating the information, need to be paid. So when everything's free, and when there's a culture of free, and when there's an increasingly permissive culture around intellectual property, and people increasingly turn a blind eye to intellectual theft, it's a very serious problem for the creative community.
Well, piracy is one of the largest crimes worldwide of all intellectual properties. I mean, that's one of the biggest going. My statement had nothing to do with that. It's more of tainting the product so that there's a hook that makes them want to pay for it. If you're creating
product... I'm not clear on the question. Could you repeat that?
Well, I think that a lot of situations take place where there's so much redundancy of information between all the collective news agencies that it's very hard to make it a hook or palatable piece of exchange, and that you have something. If you take all the news agencies that are on TV, you can surf each one of those. They all have the same thing, but they're all the ones that are going to get the higher numbers are going to be the ones that are sensationalizing the story or getting a hook on it that no one else has. And it's the same thing with written press. If you're talking about news, if you're talking about entertainment, that's a whole other product.
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't see. What's your point? What are you trying to say?
Well, I think you just made a comment.
I guess I really have no point at this point.
No.
Yeah,
well,
be clear about what you're saying. In a sentence, what's your argument?
No, I think my listening to Morgan, he's basically, it's very hard to differentiate these various platforms, and he, I guess in his view, certain platforms use sensationalized means to draw an audience.
Well, I don't think that's true. I think, for example, let me give you an example. There was a couple of weeks ago, there was a wonderful story in the New York Times about the impact of the economic crisis on middle classes, on unemployment. It was a piece that was researched by, I don't know, 5 or 10 professional journalists. It was beautifully written. It was very moving, and it was full of valuable factual information. Now, this was a high-quality product, which I would have—I did pay for because I'm a subscriber to the New York Times. Now, you can go onto Wikipedia and find a lot of garbage. You can go onto the blogs and find rubbish. But if the caller is saying that most of the content on the internet is rubbish, he's right. If the caller is saying that all the information on the internet is rubbish, he's wrong. The caller is saying that you can't differentiate between the New York Times and the blog of some ignoramus who thinks they know everything. He's wrong.
Unfortunately, most of the people that are on the internet or read cannot differentiate between a, you know, they don't really know where the information's come from, and they a lot of times will base a lot of information that is bogus as being true. Wikipedia has been raved for a long time as being a really good source of information, yet it's probably the highest misinformed website on the internet. It doesn't matter really so much how accurate the information is if the people who are reading it can't differentiate between substantial accurate information from made up nonsense to look accurate. And most you're seeing a lot of that out there. I can't tell you the number of people who come into my office and spout off things that they've read from legitimate websites for major news agencies that were totally false, totally fallacious, and had no substantiation of any kind, and I had to spend an hour breaking that down to get them to the reality section before I could help them move on to the next problem.
Thank you,
well,
Morgan, for
that,
your call.
You know, the problem there is that people are ignorant and lazy. It's not media's fault. They're fat and lazy, and they're watching crap, or they're not willing to read books, or they're not willing to digest information in a coherent way. So you can't blame media for that.
Yeah,
that's a very big problem with this country. You only have to read the nonsense people believe about terrorists and UFOs, but it's not media's fault. It's people are ignorant.
Morgan, thank you very much for your call. You know, demographically, it's interesting. I have two daughters. I have three children. One son is in Rome this semester, struggling.
Oh, nice.
Studying in Rome while he's away from Indiana University.
Lovely.
Yes, and he's struggling with his life, of course. And my other daughter, 16 and 13.
Why is he struggling?
I'm kidding. Tonight he's out in Rome. He was in Barcelona this weekend, and he's heading over to Amsterdam this coming weekend. So everything points to me wanting to be my son, of course, in my next life.
Yeah.
But I had an interesting conversation with my daughters. I have a 16 and a 13-year-old, and we were sitting there, and I'm in the business of owning a web company. And, you know, advertising is a component of what we do. Fortunately, it's a small component of what we do. And I said to my young daughter, who's 13, who just joined Facebook about a month ago, I said, let me ask you a question. You know, on the Facebook page, there's these boxes on the right side. Do you ever click on any of those? Those are ads. And my young daughter said, you know what, Dad, I actually did once. And my older daughter, who's 16, said, oh, my God, that is disgusting. I was just taken aback by that, it's just
disgusting
unbelievable.
By what?
Disgusting that my younger daughter actually clicked on an ad.
I think what she's talking about is that there is this, but what you're alluding to is this, what I would call this culture of authenticity, which I think is very unhealthy, where people don't trust, people don't want advertising, and they think that technology has liberated them from advertising. So people now like the TiVo machine or these other DVR products that allow them to skip advertising on television, and they won't click on the advertising on the internet. But what they don't understand is if they don't click on the advertising, then they won't get high-quality content.
Well, they're kids.
This stuff isn't for free.
Of course, but they're kids, right? So I'm just saying the culture is such that grew up with, you know, stealing music.
Well, you have a responsibility to edge. I hope you were.
Of course I did.
Your daughter a good talking to.
Of course I did. So I said to my older daughter when she reacted so virulently, I said, "Well, let me ask you a question. What do you think happens?" She says, "What do you mean?" I'm like, "I think you get viruses and you get, you know," she just kind of reeled off these things, but they're just accustomed to free content.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Well, free is a very, very dangerous. Free is an ideology, and it's an ideology which points to what I would call, maybe not the cult of the amateur, but the cult of the consumer, the idea that the consumer is always right, and that companies exist for the benefit of the consumer. And companies don't. Companies exist for the benefit of their owners and their stockholders and their employees and for the benefit of making money. So internet companies have no responsibility towards benefiting their consumers rather than themselves. Google has done a brilliant job presenting itself as a public interest company that's only purpose is to benefit the consumer. And this is an ideological trick they pulled off so cleverly that they're laughing all the way to the bank. But consumers should be under no illusion on all this. But I think the ideology of the consumer is a very, very dangerous one. It's dangerous also in politics. It's dangerous in the way in which people are told continually that they're in charge, and of course they're not. And when they are, things go downhill rather fast.
But then you have Chris Anderson, who writes the book Free, that gets huge amount of press. And what do you make of that?
Anderson is, you know, it's a classic. Look, Anderson was paid $500,000, $750,000 to write that book.
Right.
And the irony of that was that he got involved in a plagiarism scandal. Parts of the book, which actually I got as a reviewer, had been lifted from Wikipedia. Now, he claims that it was a mistake, but there is no level of paradox there. You write a book called Free. You're paid $750,000 or $500,000 or $750,000 to do it, and then parts of the book are found to be plagiarized. So, again, that story reflects or reveals the absurd paradoxes in our world, where we believe in free, and a tiny group of people are actually benefiting, profiting massively from this, and perpetrating, really what it comes down to is a kind of hoax.
Right, well, why wasn't the
whether
book
it's
free?
Anderson or the people at Google, what?
Why wasn't the book free?
Wants free. I mean, everyone wants
right.
Everyone wants books which say you can lose 50 pounds in 30 seconds. Everyone wants books that say you only have to work 4 hours a week. Everyone wants books that tell you you're beautiful. You can believe all that crap. But ultimately, they're just commodities intent on profiting from stupid people. When it comes down to it, really. I mean, the whole ideology of free is absurd.
It is absurd. It's difficult to follow.
The funny thing is that we live in this culture of sort of disbelief, of absurdity, that you can pull these ridiculous hoaxes, and then when people call someone like Anderson on free, you're accused, like myself, of being a reactionary or a Luddite.
But the most influential VC in our day, at least this day, these last 2-3 years, Fred Wilson, is a huge proponent of free, of course.
Well, did you read my piece about, Wilson isn't really, Wilson's the noisiest. He's not a very successful VC. He just happened to be lucky and invested in Twitter.
That's delicious,
it's still not clear how much money that's worth. He failed in the 90s as a VC. The cleverest VCs are the people like Mike Moritz at Sequoia. They don't have anything to do with free. So I wouldn't agree. I would say Wilson is a masterly self-publicizing VC, but he's not a great VC.
No, okay. Fair enough. I mean, his investment in Twitter looks like it works. We have another call. We'll like to take this from Regina. You're on Blog Talk Radio, The Alan Levy Show. How are you, Regina?
Excellent. How are you?
Good. So where are you calling in from, and what do you do?
I'm calling in from Rhode Island, and I am one of your esteemed hosts on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you for 2.5 years of fantasticness.
Thank you. What's your show?
Regina's Universe, live and uncensored. It's on at 10. And I just happened to catch this tonight.
Oh, on at 10.
We're on the Today's Picks today, which was very exciting, so thank you very much.
Very good. Who's your guest tonight?
The People of Walmart guys, which are the second time on the show. These guys are hysterical, so it's going to be a fun one.
Are they trashing Walmart?
Yeah, they're the ones that put the pictures up of the people.
Right. Walmart, I don't know. Walmart used to be a customer of ours on Blog Talk. Wait a minute. We're going to have to remove it from Today's Picks.
Yeah.
Andrew would love that sort of censorship, would you, Andrew?
Sorry, say that again.
I'm saying that Regina has a guest on today. She's on. I don't know if you've been to Blog Talk Radio. Your lovely picture's there on the homepage.
Oh,
Andrew.
Okay.
We clipped it from your website, but Regina has a show on Blog Talk Radio. She's hosting tonight, and it was included in today's picks. And just briefly mention who are the authors again, and what book did they write, Regina?
Oh, they run the website peopleofwalmart.com. So Luke Wary and Adam Kippel, and people take pictures of people in freakish outfits in Walmart, and they've made an absolute cult industry out of it. It's really
I've seen that. What's your question for Andrew?
Andrew, I'm so happy that I happened to cross paths with the show tonight, and I haven't read your book yet, but I just ordered it now.
I'm curious
about, and I wish I had hours to talk to you, I'm curious about your thoughts. You were talking about implementing a paywall, how that would, better differentiate different types of news. My question to you is that even reputable sources of information like the New York Times, they also employ bloggers, and it's a lot of opinion-based news on top of actual news. So how would a paywall solve that kind of battle? Because one of the callers had said, some people just don't know the difference between what's actual news and what's really just opinion-based fodder. So would a paywall stop that?
Well,
even for...
Uh, look, when the New York Times did try a paywall a few years ago, in which they actually gave their news away for free, and they charged for their columnists. So they charged for Maureen Dowd and Thomas Friedman and Bill Kristol and the other notable columnists. So I would actually disagree with you. I think that the news is increasingly commodified. And it's very, very hard to charge for fact-based news. I think it's easier to charge for a couple of things. Firstly, well-researched stories, which are unique, like the story about middle-class unemployment in America. But secondly, I would strongly disagree with you about columns. I mean, you give someone who's even half literate, you give them a piece by Maureen Dowd, which is beautifully polished and funny and elegant, and then you give someone some grammatically piece by somebody who has no real writing skills, it would be obvious, in the same way as when you walk into a restaurant. You don't ask for fat-based food, but anyone can tell the difference between a high-quality meal in a good restaurant.
I think that some people may not, with the fact that there are people that use Wikipedia every day that don't know the difference.
Yeah, but those are the people in food. If someone can't tell the difference between what they eat in a fast food restaurant and what they eat in Chez Panisse in Berkeley, then they'll eat in the fast food restaurant. They're missing out. In the same way, some people can't tell the difference between a Maserati and a Honda, and they're happy with a Honda. In the same way, some people can't tell the difference between going to Las Vegas and going to Rome, so they're happy in Las Vegas. I mean, there are always going to be people with bad taste. There are always going to be people who can't differentiate. I can't tell the difference between a fine wine and a cheap wine, and I drink any wine, but I'd never buy an expensive wine. I can tell the difference, though, between a piece by Maureen Dowd or Thomas Friedman, even if I don't always agree with what they're saying, and an 800-word piece by someone on the Internet who isn't saying anything. So, and if you're right, if nobody can tell the difference.
Oh, I didn't say that.
If indeed we come to a situation where, 99% of readers can't tell the difference between a Thomas Friedman or a Maureen Dowd column and something written by somebody on the Internet, then you'll just see the end of the professional columnist and the end of the professional press.
I think,
and that's for better or worse. I think it'd be a catastrophe, but that's a reality because no one will pay for this stuff, and it won't have any value anymore.
I think part of the problem is the information overload. There's so many choices and options to consume content, and of course, Thomas Friedman is a wonderful writer and certainly stands above most. But there's so many, it's like the world is ADD. No one has attention for anything anymore. And I was at the United Nations. They're beginning to embrace new media, interestingly. And, of course, the Pentagon has been written out a lot about that. And they're thinking about ways, and they, of course, need to be on these platforms. And the gentleman that runs the global communication platform for the United Nations says, doesn't anyone read a newspaper anymore? I mean, he's got, and the world has ADD. It's just fascinating. This information overload, the society, I see it happening. So,
well, but if that's the case, which it may well be, then we need the Friedmans of this world to filter the news.
Right.
So I think if we give up on the value of high quality, I mean, and you could make the same argument then about books. You could make the same argument now. There are all these self-publishing services. What's the difference between, somebody who just picks up a laptop and bangs out 60,000 words and self-publishes? What's the difference between that and the latest book by Margaret Atwood or John Grisham? I mean, there are major differences. It's really hard to write a good book. It's really hard to fly a plane. It's really hard to make a fine meal. it's really hard to paint a great picture. Writing or creativity is no different from anything else. It doesn't mean people are better. It just means that they're better trained, they're more disciplined, and they're more able and generally more talented.
It's just challenging for
me. I mean, what about the lady who called? Does she have a response? Has she disappeared?
She's off the line, and she's preparing for her next show, which is featured on the network tonight.
But I often hear this argument, and I think, again, people are mixing up morality, goodness, and ability. I mean, just because you're good at writing doesn't make you a superior person. It just means that you're good at writing.
So what do you think, where are we headed here? I mean, I know it's a general question, but, you know, you see what's going to work? What model will work? Will it be more consolidation with newspapers? Will the monetization improve online, digitally?
Yeah.
What do you see happening
with
these platforms?
Well, I think we're coming off the mass industrial media age in which most people had access to the same information, and same entertainment economy, and it was generally a reasonably high quality and a high standard and reliable. What we're falling into, in my view, is a less democratic era, which is ironic given that the boosters on the internet are always talking about democracy, where newspapers like the New York Times and publishing business and the movie business, they'll probably survive, but they'll become increasingly high-end, increasingly inaccessible for the masses. And you're going to see a massive gulf, the disappearance of the middle, and you're going to have services like Wikipedia, as one of your call-in people said, is really bad, but everyone thinks it's good. You're going to have a lot of free garbage on the internet, unedited, unmediated, unfiltered. And then you'll have a small high-end of high-quality information that will have a paywall, you'll see the disappearance of mass society. So ignorance is not beneficial. I mean, the people in power, the people on the coasts, the people in Silicon Valley, the people in New York, they'll continue buying newspapers. People who run Google will still buy newspapers. But most ordinary people won't, and so it's rather sad. I think we're seeing this disappearance of the middle. It's taking place at the same time as the disappearance of the middle in economic terms and in cultural terms. But you know, the garbage that's served up is free. Is really, as one of your callers said, it's awful. It's irresponsible, and it sort of feeds on ignorance. So we'll have a vicious cycle at the low end, and a virtuous cycle at the high end, and very little in between. And I think increasingly we will be nostalgic for the mass media age in which the vast majority of people had the same access to the same high quality and affordable content.
Hmm. Well, it's a bit ominous down there, but there's obviously lots of change that's going to be taking place, so...
Yeah, well, I think that one of the reasons, again, in all seriousness, why people call me the Antichrist, or why I sort of joke around with this Antichrist label, is because people take it for granted that technological change is good. And I question that. It doesn't make me a Luddite. I mean, I certainly believe in medical science. But there are many other technological advances, especially when it comes to armaments, and perhaps even the motor car, which aren't necessarily good. And I think that in retrospect, we will see a lot of these media changes as being bad for the cultural businesses, bad for the creative class, bad for musicians, bad for writers, bad for movie makers, because they're losing their livelihood. Now, there's no conspiracy here. I mean, you know, Google isn't conspiring. They happen to be a very smart group of people who have figured out a new business model for the new age. They're not doing it on purpose. They don't get any pleasure out of making people unemployed. But the unintended consequences of Google and Craigslist and YouTube and MySpace and even Twitter are increasingly hard for journalists and writers and filmmakers and radio presenters to make any money. And that's why all these people are losing their jobs. So it's not a good situation. And, you know, Americans like to always think positively and optimistically. But there may not be a positive, optimistic outcome to this thing. It's never guaranteed.
My guest has been Andrew Keene, and it's been a wonderful interview. Andrew, thank you very much for joining me.
Yeah, well, good luck, and very nice, and good luck with your show. It sounds excellent.
Wonderful. I'll send you the link. Thank you very much for joining
me.
Good luck
with everyone.
Radio.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining Alan and Hillary on The Alan Levy Show. Make sure to join the conversation by calling 347-677-0649 and listen to The Alan Levy Show on Blog Talk Radio.